ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The numbers of Russians dying in the Ukraine war remind us of World War I carnage.
Alongside deplorable stories of exploitation by officers upon recruits. And yet, Putin persists.
How strong is his control over his narrative of reclaiming the Russian Empire?
And is that control beginning to waver at all in this epic war of choice? I'm Latika Burke.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and this is Global Roaming. You know, I've been looking forward to this episode, Latika, if looking forward is the right way to think about it. I mean, we've all heard the terrible stats. I think they are sort of more or less repeated, you know, from various centres of strategic studies and so on about from February 22, Russian forces have suffered nearly 1.2 million casualties, more losses than any major power in any war since World War II. But then there was this truly ghastly. I mean, I don't know how to describe it, what proper adjective is required, in The Economist back in April, about called dead souls, that in effect, on the front lines, Russian soldiers have to pay their officers to stay alive, to not be forced into that the death zone, which is because the Ukrainian drones have established this, I think it's a 20K zone where you basically...
The kill zone.
Yes, so you pay to basically be right at the back line, so you're not sent in there. It's just so deeply shocking that I think it sort of alerted people to ask the question again: How is Putin getting away?
Why are you shocked?
Why was I shocked?
This is Russia. This is what they do. This is what Putin does. This is what being an autocrat means.
Yes, and this is what they did in World War II as well, with the Germans at the gates of Moscow, basically. You know, out came Stalin and said, you know, after he got out of his fetal pose because he was so panic-ridden, everybody has to throw everything for Mother Russia to survive. And they did. So I do know about the history. I don't know. It hit me. It really, I just thought, how can this been happening in the 21st century?
This is a big topic in Ukraine. So, one, the salaries that the Russians are paid to go and fight is enormous, and that's what's been keeping the conscription model, the mobilisation going for Putin. But, Geraldine, as of around February this year, and I remember this briefing distinctly, it was with the so-called Western officials. You may have seen that reported a lot. Anyway, these Western officials said that they've reached the point now where they are killing more Russians than Putin can mobilize. This is an interesting pressure point because even in this war of robotics and drones, you still do need men. And does that mean Putin then has to start go tapping on the shoulders of middle-class families or some of these people who've been quarantined from mobilization until now? That could be something that fractures Russian society. But I do have to say, I think myself included, we all get a bit carried away reading the runes, reading the criminology, trying to look for things sometimes that may not even be there within Russian society. Maybe they can just withstand this and go on and on and on.
Well, I mean, it is also true that it's producing profound impacts in surrounding areas. Like I think in Poland's, I mean, it is really an amount because I think they are spending close to 5% actually now, and the role that they might play eventually in Ukraine's reconstruction. So it is possible to see some strands emerging, isn't it? And that's what you're alluding to around Russia. I can't help it. I just keep looking for... whether there's something from within.
Well, yes, of course, we've got to live for hope, Geraldine. Otherwise, what do you have? Let me share with you one little piece of information I just picked up over the course of the last week via some Ukrainians, which will make you smile. So the Ukrainians are doing rather well at developing their long-range capabilities, and they've now got very good strike capability within 200 kilometres. And why is that important? Anything they hit within 200 kilometres, that means that, so that's basically logistics, which is a really, really big deal for war and military operations. They don't have to rely on US intelligence. They can do that all themselves with their own weapons. So you're starting to see the Ukrainians develop their own sovereign capability. Maybe it's not too impossible to dream of a future where Ukraine can 100% stand on its own two feet.
Gosh. Well, look, there are so many competing narratives. I really wanted to reach out to somebody whom I've been following I follow a range of people, and we will actually put some other good reading material. There's some fantastic books coming out for people who want to try to keep up with this in terms of internal Russian behaviour. But one of the better interpreters of contemporary Russia is a man called Peter Pomerantsev. He's a former journalist and he's now a writer, analyst, of how modern autocracies both maintain their control but also reach into democracies using non-military means. He is the co-founder of The Reckoning Project, which documents Russian crimes in Ukraine. And I think you'll get a lot from listening to Peter Pomerantsev. Here he is now. Peter Pomerantsev, welcome to Global Roaming.
Hi, thank you for having me.
The fact that this military parade on May the 8th, the Great Patriotic War Parade, will not have any overt military equipment because they're too afraid of long-range Ukrainian drones. Now, that makes it all very visible, the results, some results of the Ukraine war. Will that start to penetrate Russian consciousness? How do you judge it?
Right. So the most of sort of sociology that we look at, looking at sort of the Russian population, identifies kind of the main strain of propaganda that's very popular there as something that sociologists call collective narcissism, which is actually popular in many authoritarian and also populist movements. And essentially, it's the feeling of greatness associated with your country, your culture, superiority to others, all souped up with a victim narrative. I think we all can recognize it. You know, it's the sort of propaganda, which is often very popular, which says we're better than everybody else, but we're not recognized for it. We deserve people's respect and so on and so forth. I mean, we see a bit of it in America as well. So what's interesting with that model of propaganda, that even though it's fixated with the word we, yeah, with you know, some sort of sense of supremacism of your culture and country, it doesn't actually give a monkey's about anybody else in that country. Yeah, it's all about you feeling great because you're associated with victories and humiliating others. So that's how you get this kind of paradox where you have leaders across the world and then societies like Russia's, where there's a prevalent mood of, on the one hand, lapping up the sense of greatness, wallowing in the sense of victimhood, but actually no empathy to other members of society, because it's just about your feelings. It's not a genuine feeling of connection to other people in the society. So that's where you think you get the paradox of people who scream about the greatness of their culture and then don't care that people live in poverty or destitution. So in Russia, when it's sort of polling that I did at Hopkins, where I work, the university, together with University of Chapel Hill and Georgetown, we found something like 55% of Russians indulged in that, and they became more so when exposed to propaganda around the war. So that's a sizable majority of the country really not giving a hoot about losses. They don't care about their own soldiers. It's not sort of inbuilt into that model. So this hope, I think, that a lot of people had in the West and in Ukraine at the start of the war, that if enough Russian soldiers died, it would damage the push for war, I think that was always based on a misunderstanding of the propaganda and the society. It's a very atomized society, not very strong feelings of connection. So if some poor people die, who cares? It's a very callous society, a society with a very high tolerance for mass murder historically and with no kind of reckoning for it. So I'm not surprised at all that there's been no care about the sort of the massive Russian losses. However, what we do find in the polling is that if you want to undermine support for the war, you do show that it is not bringing greatness, but is actually increasing the things Putin claimed that he would deal with. So crime, a sense of economic instability, a sense of social instability, which is why Putin works so hard to sort of keep most Russians kind of in a different reality from the war. Yeah. And I suppose you're right. This May the 9th moment, this idea that you won't have this grand parade, might sort of exacerbate the sense that Putin isn't in control. So Putin's rule, his aura is dependent on this idea that he is in control, that he is a protector, and he's a distributor of wealth between different clans. That's his two functions. And if he starts being unable to guarantee, on the one hand, security and stability, on the other hand, financial distribution between clans and regions, then something's in question. But don't for a moment think it has anything to do with the lives of soldiers, let alone the lives of Ukrainians.
And yet, I've been reading, Peter, a lot of research, some leaks even via the Russian ombudsman, suggesting that there is a lot of societal angst about the way Russian soldiers in particular, the veterans, are being treated. So some are being returned to the front line swiftly, still wounded. Some were handcuffed to trees, unbelievably, to stop them from fleeing the front line. Are these stories and these cases and examples not taking a toll at all?
This is just the way soldiers get treated in the Russian army. There's nothing new about it. It might undermine mobilization. So, well, not mobilization, conscription. So they are, Russians are struggling with conscription. They're, as you probably know and your listeners know, they pay unheard of sums for a poor Russian to join the army. $30,000, which is a lifetime salary for many people. And that's really been a very effective way, frankly. It worked very well. They're now struggling with it, partly because people feel that, you know, yes, they'll get the money, but then they'll never survive to see it. So that can undermine conscription. That's very important. But the idea that a Russian soldier gets treated like very badly is, that's always been part of the Russian army. So there's nothing new there. What story we see, again, undermining confidence in the system is the idea of veterans coming back and then committing crime. So Putin's whole story is that he dealt with the crime of the 1990s. That's the whole propaganda is built on that. Russia was a crime-infested, humiliated hellhole, and Putin made it great again. Yeah, that's the number one narrative that Putin pushes. When we see veterans coming back, and there's these stories, because many of them are criminals, yeah? They were let out of prison, they go and serve, they come back, they rape, they kill, they murder. Those stories, people are very sensitive to. And crime statistics have been censored by the Russian government because they know it's very sensitive. So that story, the idea of veterans coming back and causing, well, firstly, psychological discomfort because no one really wants to look at them or think about them, but also causing crime, that does undermine the aura of strength and stability that Putin tries to project.
Peter, we were always told at the start of the war, and certainly this is the theory I shared, which is that only the elites can really tap Putin on the shoulder should it ever come to that and say it's time is up, or China, of course, but talking now within Russia. Is that still the case? And do we see any sign of that?
So you're right, it's not a democracy. I mean, there's no vote, there's no election. So in that sense, the theory of change is always going to be an elite theory of change. Historically, apart from a couple of very, very famous exceptions in 1917 and 1991, change in Russia has been through some sort of palace coup, or that's just the way the system works. It's an autocratic system where things get decided at that level. But social pressures are very important. You know, if Putin loses control over society or key parts of the economy, then that enables other members to tap him on the shoulder or just double tap him, so to speak. So society does matter. But in terms of, you know, the future of the war, there's a very clear and very open debate among the Russian elites about whether it's worth continuing it. You see this in the sort of continuous assertions of kind of the economic bloc. So that's the head of the central bank, to some extent the prime minister, and other kind of economists in the system, basically constantly telling Putin, we're going to have a terrible economic year. And they've been saying that a lot since the start of the year, you know, very openly. You know, they'll say, like, we're going to have, if this goes on, the economy is going to crash. You know, if this goes on, the labor market is ruined and so on. And I'm assuming in here, this is all criminology, that this is partly in time to Trump's ridiculously generous offers of peace terms. So one can imagine, and again, here we're into guesswork, obviously, but Kirill Dmitriev, the very unpleasant individual who does the kind of negotiations with Trump's team and some of the people connected to him, making the case, look, the economy is not doing great. It might not be sustainable. Let's take this deal. We've been offered ridiculously good terms. We probably won't get better ones. You know, definitely won't get better ones with another American administration. Let's do it. And Putin apparently has been considering it very seriously. At the start of the year, he had two envelopes on his table. That's what all the sort of analysts were saying. One envelope said, go on fighting. The other one said, take this opportunity. And he's gone for the go on fighting one. As there's no progress on the front, you again hear, you know, the economists going, well, we've got a terrible future ahead. We have now a tax on the head of the central bank, which is new, which shows there's a real tussle there. But look, Russia is not a democracy, but neither is it China and Xi Jinping. There is a certain amount of pluralism that's allowed to have some sort of debate at kind of elite levels. So we shouldn't be surprised by that. That's kind of how the system functions.
I'm Latika Burke with Geraldine Duke on Global Roaming. We're speaking with Peter Pomerantsev about Russia's struggle to keep the war narrative under control.
You've also said that Russia excels in non-military means of projecting power outwards. Now, where is that particular part of the war, in your view, as this stasis has developed?
I mean, I think it's always important to someone like Putin, who's not really a military guy. But you're right, that's a very good point, that as the front line becomes more jammed, political warfare becomes more important, and the war of perception. So influencing whatever goes on inside the space of Donald Trump's brain, influencing politics in Europe. So losing an ally in Mali, which is a setback for them, but they had also a lot of wins in Africa before then. They lost an ally in Venezuela, which they will be a little bit annoyed about. And of course now Iran is, you know, it's unclear what the story is going to be there. But Russia thinks globally. It never stopped thinking like a global power. And it's always thinking about sort of the balance of alliances and friendships it has across the world.
As a sidebar, the role of politicized religion in all of this, the role of the Patriarch Kirill of the Russian Orthodox Church, who sort of really sanctified this cult of heroic death and martyrdom, which I presume is playing into exactly what you're describing, is there any further critique of him, or is he still as powerful as he ever was?
I wouldn't call it an independent power. I think it would be a mistake to look at him like the Pope or something. The Russian Orthodox Church is a branch of the Russian security services, like military intelligence is. It's a front organization, essentially, from the point of view of the Kremlin, which is used for various political operations domestically and then subversion, rioting, and espionage internationally. I mean, I do not for a moment wish to impede on people's spiritual or emotional relationships with the Orthodox Church, which can be varied and different, and I respect that. But as an organization, it is, from the point of view of the Kremlin, it's a tool, and it fulfills very necessary jobs in Africa, recruiting mercenaries and soldiers, in Moldova, fomenting insurrections, in Ukraine, helping to organize military operations. So they see it as a front that fulfills security missions. At the same time, it functions as a church as well. And again, I do not for a moment wish to question people's spiritual relationship. But for the Kremlin, it's that. And we have to understand that. That makes it very, very hard, because obviously, whenever Ukrainians or Moldovans point out that the Russian Orthodox Church is actually a branch of the Russian security services, the answer is always around freedom of religion. And it's very hard and very sensitive to question its role, let alone take measures against it, which the Ukrainians have. And of course, you know, the Ukrainians, so one has to be very careful with the wording here. They banned the Moscow Patriarchate of the Orthodox Church, so its offices, you know, and the church doesn't ban the religion. There's a Ukrainian Orthodox Church and there's a Greek Orthodox Church and there's many others. So it's not about banning the religion, it's about banning the organization that controlled some parishes in Ukraine, not actually that many. But obviously the moment that's happened, that is then leveraged by Russian propaganda. It's channeled very, very effectively to bits of the Republican Party. Most notably, J.D. Vance has become a real recycler of deeply biased takes on this. So it's a really hard and slippery subject.
If we'd had this conversation a year ago, I think many would have said Ukraine is on the back foot. Ukraine is the party that might lose this. Actually, coming out of the deep winter they had, they're now conducting successful strikes on the oil refineries. They're bringing on their own long-range capability. Is there a chance that if this war does grind on for another year, this time next year, it's Ukraine that's on the front foot?
So I spent around half my time in Ukraine. I was there all through winter, and there is definitely a sense of elation after the winter. The winter was quite hard, but then not as hard as we feared. It was Russia really throwing everything it had at Ukraine, destroying the critical infrastructure, but also unleashing one of its mythical forces, which is General Winter, you know, which in Russian mythology destroyed Napoleon and Hitler. And somewhere in February, I remember us all looking at each other going, this was hard. I was, for the first time, I did humanitarian work as well, apart from my academic work, giving out soup in Kyiv suburbs, which is something I'd embarrassingly not done since the start of the war. But it was that sort of feeling that we really had to all help each other. But then kind of halfway through, we all realized we'd get through it. Definitely moments of humanitarian crisis, but overall, we dealt with it fairly easily, as in like relatively to what we feared. I think the fear was much bigger. And I think there's something bigger here that we all should consider, which is to do with Russian mythology and how we mythologize Russia and how we perceive it. I think deep down, many of us who've grown up with a certain map, a geographical map and a cultural map, are used to Russia being the hegemon in that space. It's the big power, you know, it's big and it's inevitable. And it has big books and big music and big dictators. And it's just big. And in a weird way, that size will tell. And all Ukraine can do is maybe, you know, sue for minimal sovereignty, but not even that. I think it's worth taking a step back. Historically, that's actually a very recent phenomenon, you know, from the sort of 18th century, really, where Russia becomes the local hegemon. Before that, we had a patchwork of powers, but really the kind of dynamism, intellectually, militarily, educationally, came from kind of a network of powers spreading from the Baltics to the Black Sea. And obviously, Kiev and Rus was a huge player throughout that period. I mean, earlier and then into the kind of early Renaissance. So I think we need to put our historical lenses on. Russia will not always be the hegemon in the region. Yeah. It doesn't have to be. It's not inevitable. I think what we're going to see, what we're seeing is a massive historical turning point. And I'm not even talking about a year from now. I'm talking about a decade from now, 2 decades from now. We will see the emergence of new pillars of economic dynamism, military strength, and power. And there is absolutely no inevitability historically that Russia needs to survive as the local superpower. And if you look at the underlying dynamics, demographically, educationally, and especially as we move away from fossil fuel dependence, which is the last thing Russia has, I mean, this is deeply, deeply connected to a changing towards a more green economy. But as we move away from fossil fuel dependence, then I think unless Russia has some massive course correction, its power over the region is just going to fade and fade and fade. And it is Kyiv with some other places, as has been historically, that we will think of as the local superpower.
Marvellous place to win, Peter. Peter Pomerantsev, thank you very much indeed for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Peter. A superpower in Ukraine, Geraldine. I'm not sure I hear those words very often.
No. Look, I actually found myself, when he was talking about the way they coped with the winter, I found that you were moved.
You were quite moved, weren't you?
Could you see that? I was very moved indeed. And it sort of, you know, it sounded to me like the Blitz in London. You know, it's just some sort of massive emotional turning point within Ukraine.
May I use his word? I think it's going to be a mythology in itself for the Ukrainians, because you remember I was there in February as they were coming out of this winter.
Of course.
And Kylie and I spoke to Yuri Sack for Global Roaming, and that was one of the first things he said, and I'd seen him privately before, and he'd said it on the record to us, which was, now that we've come out of this, we actually feel a bit invincible, like Putin has tried everything and he couldn't break us and he couldn't turn us on each other. We can now do anything. And that, I just this week had dinner with a Ukrainian government official here in London, on his way through, and he said exactly the same thing again. So I think this is living very strongly in the Ukrainian mindset that they survived that winter.
Well, let's keep watching that space. Look, don't forget to write to us, will you? We do love your questions and feedback, and particularly, you know, such a thought-provoking discussion that Peter Pomerantz have provided us with. We have an email, for instance, from Tony in Canberra. We often hear that Russia's economy is equivalent in size to that of Spain. I'm interested in how Russia is capable of posing such a significant and ever-increasing strategic threat to Europe, despite the economic mismatch. What is it about the Russian economy and military industrial sector that makes it such a disproportionately potent threat?
I think I can throw in a couple of answers there. I think one of them is self-deterrence. And we saw that with, you know, don't underestimate how real the threat of use of nuclear tactical weapons is. And that was a very prevailing strong threat in the first few years. And so I think that has now abated, and you will have seen Putin himself has calmed down that rhetoric. But don't underestimate how important that was in the first few years of the full-scale invasion.
Well, that was allegedly, sorry to interrupt, that was Biden pulled back. There were those crucial 11 days when they started to believe that he really may use those small tactical nuclear weapons, and they sort of pulled back.
Exactly. And then the second thing I would say is Putin has a very hot war economy, and that means he almost needs the war to keep going. And it is backed by China. So I was speaking to someone in the UK government who said, you know, without telling you the classified material, I can tell you that Russia would not be in this war any longer if it were not for China. They've sent them everything by the bullets. So they do have a very powerful supplier on their side. If and when that ever were to change, I think that would be the game changer we're looking for. And I don't think that's so much a Europe mismatch. Certainly Europe is underprepared and underarmed, and they're trying to change that. But there are some other key factors there as well.
Fascinating. And it's also believed that actually it was China who said to Putin, stop talking about nuclear weaponry.
That's right.
Thanks so much, Latika. And thank you to our producer, Jessie Kay, who produced this episode. Bye-bye for now, Latika.
Bye, Geraldine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.